Ik ben Thijs Paars en dit is Get Out of the Building, een podcast over start-ups en innovatie op basis van de Lean Startup methode. Wie het snelst leert, overleeft. Dat klinkt mooi, maar hoe het echt gaat in de praktijk, dat hoor je niet zo vaak. Daarom deel ik de struggles en de successen van mijn eigen start-up en van andere bedrijven. Ik praat met andere ondernemers, experts, klanten en investeerders. Welkom bij Get Out of the Building. Deze podcast is voor start-up founders, voor mensen die in een start-up team werken. En dan maakt het eigenlijk niet uit of je nou helemaal zelfstandig en bootstrapped vanuit de zolderkamer werkt. Of dat je voor een groot bedrijf werkt waarbij jij in een start-up team zit. Want jullie hebben allemaal dezelfde uitdagingen, voor een groot deel in ieder geval. In iedere aflevering probeer ik in minder dan een half uur innovatie inspiratie te geven. Dat doe ik met experts en met cases uit de praktijk. En het is allemaal gebaseerd op de Lean Startup methode. Vandaag praat ik met Eric Ries over zijn nieuwe boek The Startup Way. En we bespreken de verschillende stadia van transformatie waar grote bedrijven doorheen moeten gaan om ondernemerschap weer centraal te stellen in de organisatie.
In most organizations, if you tell them we're going to radically transform those gatekeeper functions, everyone would say you're crazy. They're too embedded, too powerful, you can never do it.
Ik stel ook een vraag aan Alexander Osterwalder, de maker van het business model Canvas, over hoe grote bedrijven zich kunnen beschermen tegen disruptie.
You know, Amazon has a leader, Jeff Bezos, who says, I want Amazon to be the best place in the world to fail. I haven't heard a lot of companies say that. But you can't get breakthrough innovation without failure.
De founder waar ik deze week mee praat is Abby Moore. Zij is de oprichter van Adopt-A-Pet. Een Amerikaanse site waar je huisdieren kunt adopteren. En we hebben het over hoe het was voor haar om met haar hele team volgens de Lean Startup methode te gaan werken.
And it's all about asking, okay, what's your hypothesis behind that? And how do you know that this is that the problem you're trying to solve is an actual problem? And how can we experiment to validate that? And just always asking questions until people are just really, really fucking annoyed with you.
Tot slot een gesprek met Tendai Vicky, die in 2015 de Corporate Entrepreneur Awards won en die we nu kennen als een van de auteurs van de Corporate Startup, samen met Esther Gons, die we in een vorige aflevering al spraken. Ik heb het met Tendai Vicky over het belang van een goed innovation framework in grote organisaties.
Yeah, so the takeaway from the book is that you should align the way you manage innovators to the way that innovators work. So one key takeaway is to ensure that you have a really great innovation framework within your organization that recognizes what an innovation journey looks like.
So Eric, in the Startup Way, you mentioned three stages of transformation. What are in core the three stages?
So this is not a checklist or some kind of prescription. This is simply an observation. This is how I've noticed it playing out over time in a lot of very different organizations. It's true, I've seen big multinational companies transform to become more agile. I've seen big government bureaucracies change the way they do product development, citizen services, IT procurement. I've seen it happen in the intelligence community. I've seen it in a lot of different government bureaucracies. And I've also seen almost the same pattern when a startup hits product market fit and has to rapidly reorganize itself into a large company. And the three phases go as follows. The first phase I call critical mass. That's trying to figure out, is there a new way of working? What is it? And how do we get the proof points? So it's about translating abstract principles, like you might learn from the Lean Startup movement, into company-specific terminology and language and practice. But it's also about finding examples, case studies, of the ideas at work in every combination of product line or division, function, and region that the company operates in. And once we've built up that critical mass, then we have the opportunity to go to phase two. Phase two is a rapid deployment of the new ideas across the entire organization. It requires the absolute buy-in of senior management to make a top-down decision to commit the organization to the new way of working. And since most organizations and most senior managers don't really want to do that, then that really establishes the key question for phase one. Senior management, what would you need to see to to be convinced that this new way of working is worth the investment of that rapid scale-up. And then, and only then, can we start to tackle phase three, the transformation of the deep systems of the corporation. Right? The deep systems are the hardest things to change. HR, promotion and advancement, resource allocation between projects, IT, finance, legal, supply chain, compliance. In most organizations, if you tell them we're going to radically transform those gatekeeper functions, everyone would say you're crazy. They're too embedded, too powerful, you can never do it. And that's why, until we have the political capital that the kind of successful hyper-growth transformation of phase two makes possible, we can't touch that stuff. But conversely, if we only ever do projects and training and coaching, powerful as those tools are, as long as we're up against the fundamental incentives of how the organization operates, we can never truly make any change permanent.
And if you, by estimate, would guess how many companies, big corporations, would be in any of those stages, what roughly would be your percentages?
It's very few. I mean, I give, where I have permission from the company to tell their stories in detail, I put those case studies in the book. There's four or five companies that I've been able to document this transformation in, and there's a handful of others that are at different phases that I haven't had yet gotten permission to talk about publicly. But it's pretty small. Now, that's not to say that there are very few companies in the world who have been transformed, just the ones where I have firsthand knowledge. And one of the funny things about these transformations is they're hard to see from the outside.
Right.
Because from the customer's point of view, all that happens is the company almost like magically starts making better products.
Right.
And when you hear from a company that they have a new version coming out, instead of saying, oh God, what do they do this time? You start to find yourself looking forward to the next thing and the next thing. So it's actually a very subtle shift externally. In order to really see these phases at work, you have to have been on the inside, you know, behind the firewall to see it up close.
So it will take a couple of decades probably before the majority of companies will have gone through all phases of transformation.
You know, if you look back at past management revolutions, that was the pattern. You know, from the time that Toyota worked out the principles of lean manufacturing for the first time, between the time that it was, you know, by far the dominant manufacturing paradigm is something like 40 years. And, you know, same thing was true for scientific management and really for the original mass production pioneers like Alfred Sloan. So management practice does change, but it can, while you're going through it, it can feel like the pace is glacial. But if you look with any kind of perspective, you see, wow, these things can change quite rapidly in the grand scheme of things.
Right. And a recent Gartner research showed that by 2021, 50% of major corporations worldwide will apply lean startup technologies. Wow.
I don't know where they come up with these. I didn't know that, but the precision of these estimates is quite remarkable.
Probably, but it also means that lean startup basics are now entering, because there's also a chapter in the startup way that mentions the back to the lean startup basics. So all back to innovation accounting, building the MVP, the pivot.
Yes, that's right.
So those techniques really still are landing right now in corporates, right?
What's amazing about it is I don't think most people realize how big the world of business is. There's just so many managers in the world today. Even that Gartner analysis, okay, let's say it's true that by 2021, 50% of companies have embraced these ideas. That sounds like an incredible accomplishment. Wow, so many. And then you realize, that's still only half.
Right.
That means that in 2021, somebody is going to pick up a book like this for the first time and say, oh, yeah, this is a good idea. Like, for them, it's brand new. So we have to be willing to celebrate how far we've come as a movement, and we have to remember that the vast majority of people who are ever going to embrace Lean Startup in history haven't even learned about it yet. That's still in the future.
Als je dit een leuke podcast vindt, laat dan een review achter in iTunes. Daarmee help je andere luisteraars om deze podcast ook makkelijker te vinden. Deel ook vooral comments met mij via Twitter of LinkedIn, zodat ik deze podcast nog beter voor je kan maken. So, Alex, running up to a Lean Startup Summit in March in Amsterdam, where you will be one of the keynote speakers, I would like to share a few questions and your answers with the audience. And the first question is, how can big companies protect themselves against disruption?
I think it's making a more serious investment in innovation. And Now, every company says, we invest in innovation. But another incubator or just a couple of people working on other projects, that's not serious investment. I'm talking about money, time, and building an innovation culture. Mm-hmm. So companies that want to survive, I think, is, I know it's a little bit hyperbole, but if they don't want to end up like Nokia, like, you know, some of these companies that we know from the corporate graveyard, it's really about redesigning the organization and creating a space for innovation to happen, giving innovation real power, mm-hmm. not conducting innovation theater. So it's a pretty fundamental change, which is hard to do, to do, but it's possible.
And it takes also the involvement of C-level management. It's something that really has to be carried from the top, right?
It can't happen without. So there are very few companies that really do this today. Amazon, best example. You know, Amazon has a leader, Jeff Bezos, who says, I want Amazon to be the best place in the world to fail. I haven't heard a lot of companies say that, but you can't get breakthrough innovation without failure. And you know, with all this lean, we think, okay, well, you just do lean, you're going to get success. That's not the case. The case is to invest in 100 companies or 100 internal startups, projects, and ideas to get 4 breakthrough innovations that will get you the 5 to 10% growth you want per year. That requires a lot of failure, not just, okay, you know, fail and learn. No, straight failures. But we want lean failures. We don't want to waste a lot of money. We want to get breakthrough innovation here.
Op 20 en 21 maart organiseer ik in Amsterdam de volgende Lean Startup Summit Europe. Je vindt er alles over op emea.leanstartup.co. Het vindt plaats in B-Amsterdam en het zijn 2 dagen vol inspiratie met keynotes, case studies, workshops, rondetafelsessies en een echte unconference. Er zijn meer dan 30 sprekers, waaronder Alexander Osterwalder, Tendai Vicky en Jeff Kothelf en vele anderen. En het gebeurt allemaal met de steun van WeWork, OneUp, ING en We Empower Innovators. Nu kun jij daar naartoe als vaste luisteraar van deze podcast met korting. Als je de kortingscode podcast invult, krijg je 10% korting. Ik hoop je te zien op 20 en 21 maart. So how did you start with lean startup, applying lean startup methodology in your company?
So at adoptapet.com, for years we functioned as a nonprofit that happened to be a website, and we found success, but it was really in spite of ourselves. You know, we never thought to talk to our customers. You know, our customers are animal shelters and people who want to adopt pets, and you know, we would build features that we thought they would like, but we never validated anything. We didn't know even to articulate assumptions. And we were all just very well-intentioned people who loved animals. And then I stumbled onto lean startup methodology.
And what was the big insight that made you change your mind about how to approach innovation?
You know, there was a time when there was a for-profit entity that wanted to acquire us. And we went very far down the road with that. And it was tempting. There was a lot of money on the table that we could have used to start another program to help animals. But I just love adoptapet.com. It was my baby. It was my child. I ate, slept, and breathed it. So at the very last moment, we decided that we were not going to sell. But we decided then that we would stop functioning, you know, as we had, and we would start trying to be a high-functioning tech company that happened to be nonprofit.
Right.
And so I started to search, and I found Lean Startup, the book by Eric Ries. And, you know, 3 pages in, I was like, oh, my God, you know, this is going to change us. But I had this team of people who were wonderful but had been so used to working in the old way. Where
and how did you include the team? Because then when you have the epiphany, that's number one, of course.
Yes.
But how did you go about that?
Well, that was the challenge, because they were so used to working in the old way, where, you know, they weren't asked to articulate assumptions or validate anything or even look back and measure success after we launched something. And so it was delicate, and I decided to use the book because I had been so inspired by the book, and I thought, well, who better to teach about lean startup methodology than Eric Ries himself? And I convened a weekly book club with my team. And, you know, it wasn't the most creative way to do it, but it worked really well.
So you picked a chapter for each week, or how did that work?
Yeah, every week I would assign one or two chapters, and like I had rules, so people had to read the chapters in advance, and I expected everybody to come prepared with questions and ideas for how the principles in that chapter could affect their work. And I really wanted everybody to speak during the meetings at least one time.
And in the current situation, because this is a few years back, so now if you've evolved as a company, how do you daily base apply validated learning, for instance, in your practice?
Yeah, we're very methodical about it, and I think the most important thing when you're starting out to use lean methodology is to make sure that you have somebody who's acting as a coach. And to be a really good lean coach, it's all about asking questions, just always asking, you know, because people get into the habit of, hey, we should do this, we should do that, this is a great idea for a feature. And it's all about asking, oh, okay, what's your hypothesis behind that? And how do you know that the problem you're trying to solve is an actual problem? And how can we experiment to validate that? And just always asking questions until people are just really, really fucking annoyed with you. But people come along, and so now it's become second nature to us. You know, we have ideas for how we can solve certain problems, but we don't, you know, jump right into solution space. We really learn about the problem, and then we start experimenting and validating our hypotheses.
And can you give an example of a good experiment that you run?
This past year, we launched a really big, like, brand new product. It's called Rehome, and it's Rehome by AdoptAPet.com, the Petco Foundation, who graciously funded the development of it. And Rehome is a product designed to help individuals rehome their pets. Previously, we had just helped shelters and rescue organizations rehome pets. But we realized that there was a market out there for people who really cared about their pets but had fallen on hard times or were moving overseas or had any number of challenges, and the options for them were not great. So I started out by just listing all of the assumptions, like starting with this is a problem, and that people would rather post their pets on a trusted website, and that they would trust us more than, like, you know, any other just generic like Craigslist type site, and that people out there wanted to adopt pets from individuals, or maybe even people who were uncomfortable adopting from a shelter would be more comfortable adopting from an individual. So I listed all of these out, and then prioritize them. Which ones are the make or break assumptions? Which are the ones that are most important to validate? And then I methodically tackled each one with MVPs, starting with a concierge MVP, where I would actually post people's pets for them, and I, you know, put together an adoption application that I would send to people who are interested in adopting pets, and then I would go to the meetings between adopters and pet owners and pets to observe.
And how did that influence your release time? So from start of this decision to implement this product until the few cycles later where you decided to roll it out, how much time was in between those?
It was vastly speeded up.
Okay.
So this concierge MVP lasted, you know, maybe a month or two, because I really felt like I had a lot of learning to do and there were a lot of assumptions to validate. And then we just started automating bit by bit. As soon as something would, and I was actually really lucky, I got to have a conversation with Eric Reese about this and ask him, like, hey, how do I know when it's time to start automating? And, you know, he said, when things become so busy that you're no longer able to keep up with the workflow, automate that piece of it.
Right.
And then just continue doing that. And that's what we did. And we got this to market very, very quickly.
Cool. And is AdoptAPet available in Europe?
No, not yet. Maybe one day, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you have plans for that someday? Because it looks scalable, right? Or is it something you do across the U.S. already?
Yes, we're U.S. and Canada, all of North America.
Right.
Also, you know, territories like Puerto Rico. I would love to come to Europe and learn about animal welfare, the state of animal welfare there, so I could figure out, all right, well, how would we need to tweak the current AdoptAPet.com, which works really well in the U.S. and Canada, to, you know, the environment in Europe.
We should design an experiment for that, right?
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Alex Osterwalder, and you are listening to Get Out of the Building, a podcast about business model design by Ty Sprungers for BNR News Radio.
So I think maybe the first question is the corporate startup, the book that you've written. There's been a lot said already about corporate startups in the last years. What made you think that there was a message that wasn't out there yet?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's been a lot said about corporate innovation. And you know what large companies should be thinking about when they're trying to do innovation. Really great books by Christensen on disruptive innovation, and you know some great models by Rita McGrath, right? And that's all good. But what I was seeing was that a lot of large companies were trying to adopt lean startup practices and bring them into their companies, but they were doing it by simply training their teams how to do lean. They weren't really thinking about what else they need to change in their company,
right,
to make it a good environment for people to be able to do lean. And so I thought that was a space there that I could make a contribution.
And is then a culture a big part of the book? Is it, because culture is the most well-known problem for big corporates to apply lean startup principles, right?
Yes, but I think that the approach we take talks about culture in a more rigorous way, right? Because when people talk about culture, it's a really flowery concept. It's like culture. And so people treat it like it's some mythical creature that comes from the mountain to bless the people.
Right.
And from our perspective, culture is one way to describe it is like what people are embarrassed to do in public.
That's a good one.
So that becomes the culture of that group of people. Exactly. So in large organizations, culture is not vague. Culture emanates from what leaders reward, celebrate, punish, what they incentivize. If I have an idea, how do I get money? What sort of ideas do the execs like, et cetera, et cetera. And that combination of things becomes the culture.
Right.
So the lever for changing the culture of a company is changing how the leaders of the company view particular types of activity.
And so what are the most important lessons from the corporate startup? What's the takeaway from the book?
Yeah, so the takeaway from the book is that you should align the way you manage innovators to the way that innovators work. So one key takeaway is to ensure that you have a really great innovation framework within your organization that recognizes what an innovation journey looks like. Mm. What are the key steps that innovators need to follow, from like customer discovery all the way through to solution creation and business models. And then ensure that when you're measuring their success, you're using similar criteria,
right,
rather than always measuring innovation by revenue. I guess the only measure we have is revenue and projections and ROI. We don't have any we don't have any measures or any metrics that tell us how close a product is to getting us to the ROI. And that's what we're trying to sort of design into the book. So that's one key takeaway, for sure.
And what's the best metric you've come across in practical examples that was better than revenue in measuring the progress of innovation in a company?
Yeah, so there is no best metric as such, right? The best metric is really around... A company needs to have the capability of being able to look at a project and recognizing where that project sits on its innovation lifecycle. Mm. This team that's working on this particular thing, right? Have they figured out the customer need? Mm. If not, why are they working on a solution?
Right.
That's asking the right question at the right time. Or, oh yeah, the team has figured out the customer need. They're now working on a solution. Oh, great. Have they figured out the right solution to meet that need?
Right.
That's an innovation question.
Right.
That's a key innovation question, because if you're not building the right solution, you're not going to be able to scale. So you can ask the five-year projection question then. And then, okay, they've got the right solution. People are really happy about it. Well, have they figured out the right business model, the right price, the right channel, the right sales force, team, whatever they need to take this to scale? And if they have, good. Now we can start to say, let's project how much money this is going to make us, because now we have all the evidence to be able to make the correct projection.
Right. And so an important thing in your keynote this morning was rhythm.
Yes.
A different rhythm from startups and corporates.
Yes.
Can you explain a bit about the difference in rhythm?
Yes. So innovation is an iterative rhythm, right? It's a rhythm that's based on doing iterations. And iterations are about, you know, testing your assumptions and learning, and then figuring out what to do next. In large companies, the rhythm is planning and then executing. So you can see the difference there.
Right.
So if I say, I don't know what I'm going to be doing next month, it doesn't work in an environment designed to plan and then execute. Right.
Right.
And so that's where the problem, that's the misalignment of the rhythms. And so we're saying, don't use plan and execute models for managing innovators, use build, measure, learn models. And then the question becomes, well, what does that look like
right.
from the manager's perspective? We know what it looks like from a team working on a product. But what does it look like if I'm managing that team? What do I need to do to align my way of working to their rhythm?
And what is the secret in that? Because how can, of course, in the bridge function, so the managers, so the so-called shit umbrella positions
right.
that have to feedback information to the classical part of the organization. What's the secret for them to translate the one rhythm to the other?
Well, you only need a shit umbrella if there's shit coming from the other side.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So
otherwise it would be a parasol, right?
Otherwise you don't need it.
No.
Right. So we don't. So we say don't. We say, how would you remove a shit umbrella?
Yeah.
The only reason we've had a shit umbrella before is because we haven't been able to communicate what's happening in the yeah. innovation space to our leaders.
Right.
Right. We've been the role of the shit umbrella is to protect the startups.
Yeah.
Until they have revenue.
Yeah.
And then you've got the right thing to take to the right.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you actually have corporate leaders that get it, that understand that innovation is a journey that where you have to hit these key steps and milestones with these metrics and these measures of success, now you don't need now corporate leadership is aligned with the shit umbrella leadership and is aligned with what startups are doing. And so that's what I do the work on, is to connect these three pieces.
Right. And then and there's the internal ambassador, as
exactly.
Alexander Osterwalder calls it, the key position. So that's actual even before there's revenue, what's the main task of this internal ambassador?
I know what you mean, right? I know what you're trying to say. And what I'm saying is, if your leadership gets it, you don't need an internal ambassador.
No, of course. Yeah. But it's making sure that leadership gets
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So the role of the internal ambassador is to make sure the leadership gets it. The role of the ambassador is not to protect one product until they get revenue. The role of the internal ambassador is to build an ecosystem where the leadership understand how to manage innovation and the innovators know how to do innovation well.
Yeah. So it's evangelizing.
Exactly. Well, more than evangelizing, designing tools and processes
right.
as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And what's next after the book?
Lying down. Taking a holiday for 3 years. It took so long to do. No, we have another book coming out at the end of the year, which is more a codification of the work we did at Pearson.
Right. Okay.
So leanproductlifecycle.com.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the place to check out that book. It's going to come out October, November time. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
In de volgende aflevering doe ik verslag van Lean Startup Nights, die we in heel Europa georganiseerd hebben. Ook kijk ik verder vooruit naar Lean Startup Summit Europe en praat ik je bij hoe het gaat met Live on Demand sinds onze pivot. Voor ideeën, feedback of vragen kun je me bereiken op LinkedIn of Twitter.